Let's get started. Now that we're in the warm part of the year, the disadvantages of this room become more and more apparent because there's hardly any oxygen in here, especially when we get a full house. And what oxygen there is, I'm planning to use up in the next hour. So I haven't actually had anybody faint in one of my lectures yet, but I'm going to have a good go at it. So let's go. We've got to go back and finish up on India and China before we get to oil-based states. So that's the first thing I'll do. As we left off last time, India was stuck. I was saying that you can follow the Japanese road and develop and grow capital internally, internal capital formation. This road was closed in the case of India because you need a strong state that can really make people sacrifice for the future, which tends to be politically unpopular. And so you need a strong government that can make people do that, which India doesn't have. Or you can follow the Chinese road, and you can depend on external sources of capital, foreign direct investment. This was also not available to India, partly because the infrastructure, physical infrastructure, was so bad that it was and still is hard to manufacture, to locate manufacturing there, and partly because the Indian government itself, with its basically anti-business philosophy, was preventing foreign direct investment from arriving, with stringent anti-investment laws and not being allowed to buy stock on the Bombay Stock Exchange if you were a foreigner, and on like that. Requirement that you have majority Indian ownership in any company that was founded in India. So foreign direct investment was so hedged around by restrictions, and the physical environment was so forbidding, that there was basically next to no foreign direct investment coming in. One of the selections, which was called Will India Catch Up with China, shows that China's foreign direct investment simply dwarfed India's by a factor of 20 or 30 or 50 at the beginning of our period. So here's India, and there are two rows, and both are blocked. Now what? Well, I was saying last week when we were discussing China that China benefited by the demonstration effects of two other countries. One, Singapore, saying that it was possible to develop your economy while still having a one-party state. So if you, the ruling party of China, want to keep your power, it's possible to do that even if you open up to the world economy. That's on the one side. And then there was the negative demonstration effect of the Soviet Union, which is, A, state socialism will lead you to stagnation and lack of competitiveness, but trying to liberalize politically and economically at the same time is extremely dangerous. So those two demonstration effects, one positive and the other negative, sort of guided China to adopt a Singapore strategy of authoritarian free market development. Now China, here we are at the end of the 1980s and the beginning of the 1990s, say 1991. Now China provides a demonstration effect to India. China has now largely decontrolled its economy, and it demonstrates and is getting rich in the process. The Chinese economy is taking over from Thailand as the world's fastest growing. India is stagnant with a growing population and poverty actually increasing in many areas. And so China provides India with a demonstration that give up on all these controls. We, China, under Mao Zedong, had the most restrictive economy in the world. We let go of that and profited as a result. So this demonstrates to India you can let go and profit as a result. Once you get the mindset that the way to develop an economy is not to, you know, put it in an iron casket, but to let it free to go to develop on its own and start getting rid of the license raj and the foreign exchange controls and the need for permits everywhere you turn and the anti-monopoly provisions that don't let the businesses grow and the labor laws that don't let you lay people off and on and on. Once you get rid of all that stuff, and start following the Chinese road, then your economy can develop. So that's the direct connection between China and India. There are also four or five points of comparison between the two, which I'll briefly mention, and then go on to oil. Okay, the first comparison is basically the obvious one, the demographic one. They're both really big. China has 1.3 billion people and is the biggest, has the largest population in the world, of course. India has about 1.05 billion people, 1 billion 50 million people. China's 1.3 billion population is hardly growing at all and is slowing to a stop. India's is still growing, though not quite as fast as before. And it's expected that by the quarter century mark, by 2025, India may actually surpass China and have the world's largest population. In addition to big populations, both were historically quite poor. Famines were found, and widespread famines killing people in the hundreds of thousands or even millions were found in both countries. Okay, so in these respects, they're rather similar. I also I mentioned the second thing last time, the soft state versus the strong state. China is a strong state. When it orders something to be done, that thing happens. If it wants to displace over a million people to put a dam in, maybe it's a good idea, maybe it's a bad idea. Maybe you think of this as putting all your eggs in one great big Three Gorges basket and a risky idea. But regardless of whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, China can effectuate it. It can get this huge project done. India is a soft state. It doesn't have one political party. I was saying last time that there was the Congress Party under Nehru, which led India to independence and which was politically dominant for the first 30 years. You might expect, and for a while it looked like it would happen, that there would be competing parties forming on both sides, the People's Party or the Janata Party on the left, and a sort of Hindu nationalist party called the BJP on the right. And that sort of happened in the 1980s, but since then, Indian politics have gotten extremely fissiparous. In other words, there are now literally hundreds of political parties competing for seats in parliament. And the large parties like the Congress Party or the Communist Party or the BJP are national parties. They run all over. But there are lots and lots of local parties, regional parties, caste parties, religious parties. And the effect is that it's impossible for any party to get more than 22 or 25% of the vote. So when you come to form a government, you form it with this huge coalition, not huge in the sense of many seats, but huge in the sense of many different partners needing to participate. And so when you have to do a deal involving, you know, say 14 other political parties before you can form a government, you can imagine what strong positions the government's going to take after that. In other words, it's not. Basically, the more parties that have to be satisfied, whether in domestic politics or internationally, the harder it is to actually move in any one direction. We'll see another example of this with the G20 at the end of the week. So the upshot is China is a strong state. India is a soft state. Next difference I want to mention is sort of springs from what I said before about the demonstration effect. There's a difference in timing. China started to open to the world economy just at the dawn, as I think of it, as the second wave of globalization in 1979 and 1980. India did not get started on this road until practically a decade and a half later, the early 1990s. And if you look at the article, Will India Catch Up with China? The author is an Indian economist who basically answers no. It'll be really, really hard. And you can see some of the huge differences. I was mentioning that foreign direct investment is way different, at way different levels in India than in China. I'm looking for the figures. They're found on page 546. And they basically say that in 2003, China received 12 times as much FDI as India. India's share of foreign direct investment is still growing. In other words, it used to constitute 0.5% of gross national product, and now it's all the way up to 1%. Meanwhile, China's around 7 or 8%. So this sort of lost decade, here's China growing through the 1980s, and India stagnant, still continues to haunt India today, just as the lost decade of the 1980s, where Latin America was not growing while Southeast Asia was, and this lost time continues to haunt the people who lost it even today. I can think of one major advantage that India does have. which is English speaking. In every era in which there's a lot of international trade, at least, one language emerges as the international language. And you can see this going all the way back to the ancient world. Greek was the lingua franca of the Eastern Mediterranean in the Hellenistic era, in the late centuries BC. In the early centuries AD through the Middle Ages, it was Latin in Western Europe. It was Swahili in East Africa. It's now French, the old colonial language in West Africa. For centuries, it was Arabic around the Indian Ocean. Well, in today, so those are lingua francas or international languages of the past. Today, of course, it's English. The English speaking is actually kind of a misnomer. You've got to divide it into two. Basically, English is a first language and English is a second language. And English as a first language is not really all that impressive. More people speak Hindi than speak English as a first language, and more people speak Chinese than speak English as a first language. And the number of Arabic speakers and Malay speakers is just short of English, and Spanish is not far behind that. So basically, English is in third place and not even a strong third in terms of first languages. But in terms of second languages, there are now 500 million. Actually, that was the last time I looked. It's probably closer to 750 million people who speak English as a second language. And they're not a random subset of the world's population. They're not your cotton farmers in Uzbekistan or your textile workers in Sao Paulo, Brazil. They tend to be the people who are personally concerned with building the international economy. If a Thai businessman goes to Japan to negotiate a bank loan, the negotiation will be in English, certainly not in Japanese or Thai. Yes, because there's no chance that the banker would speak Thai or the Thai businessman would have learned Japanese. If an Italian physicist wants to go to Sweden for a conference, the conference will be in English. So having a lot of English speakers is a decided advantage. And in this case, India, having been an English colony for well over 100 years, has a gigantic English-speaking component in its population, including virtually all of its college-educated population. So here's one thing that India does have that China doesn't, and it sort of fits in with the last thing I'm going to mention. Are we getting an international division of labor so that India and China are not really competitors but complements? They fulfill different functions. We've seen the international division of labor before. During the colonial era, the colonizing powers established an international division of labor with the colonizing power, the European power, doing the manufacturing and the colony doing the primary products. So that's one example of an international division of labor. And in fact, you can look at the dilemma confronting colonies on achieving their independence is how to move out of this division of labor and modernize and industrialize themselves. Are we getting a new international division of labor where China does the manufacturing? I was saying that China had some fantastic number, 50,000 miles of four-lane roads, and I've actually seen these roads being built. China is not India. If they say they're going to build a road from Kunming to the Lao border in the next 12 months, you can count on it. The road's going to be built, and it's going to be built in 12 months. India can't quite manage to get a road from Delhi to Jaipur, which is 150 miles. Okay? So based on its strong transportation infrastructure, China has the ability to move large quantities of goods. And thanks to the giant economies of scale that come from its industries, and particularly in low-end things, it's able to compete on a world scale in manufacturing. India is not quite like that. India would have to recreate its entire transportation network to begin to compete with China for manufacturing, and it's not quite able to do that. Okay? But what India can do is compete in communications infrastructure. We were saying at the beginning of the course that there are these huge increases in transportation productivity. It takes many fewer people on ships and ships. to move, you know, per million tons of cargo because ships are much bigger and on like that. But that dramatic as the gains in transportation have been, the gains in communications are light years faster. And you get these jaw-dropping falls in prices of 99% or 99.9% of how much it costs to make a telephone call to India or how much it costs to store a gigabyte of data and on like that. And what's more, India does not have to replace its existing communications infrastructure from the bottom up. It doesn't have to make its landlines and its copper wire at a world standard. It can just junk all that stuff and move immediately to the most advanced forms of communication. So between the fact that that communication is so much easier to develop than transportation and that India has an English-speaking capability that China doesn't have, could we see a world in which China becomes the manufacturer and India becomes the back office? Does the inventory and the tax return and interprets the X-ray and does all the stuff that you can do in digital form? So that could be. It'll be interesting to watch these guys grow anyway. So let me put that down and get to where I wanted to start today. So there's a new book by Tom Friedman called Hot, Flat, and Crowded, yeah. And in this, he's got this this kind of cocktail napkin idea of the relationship between oil and democracy. And this is basically, it's kind of this lozenge shape. And he says, as oil prices go up, the need for democracy goes down. And as oil prices go down, the prevalence of democracy goes up. So this is one of the ways in which he explains, you know, what's been going on for the last quarter century. And he cited the article that I ended up putting in the Reader in support of this idea. So I put the article in the Reader, and then I read it myself. And that's basically what I want to talk about for the next 20 minutes. There are basically three things I want to discuss. So the article argues that there is a correlation the one that Friedman believes, between democracy or lack of democracy and oil. And authoritarianism, let's say. So that raises a couple of questions, which is, how good is the proof? Second, why would there be a correlation? And let me actually take those in reverse order. In order to do this, he basically has to separate out the oil factor in whether a country is democratic or authoritarian from all sorts of other political and cultural factors that are swimming around and may well be relevant. You do this by, and for people who are interested in poli-sci, this is one of the more sophisticated examples I've seen of how to apply statistical techniques to political analysis. And basically he's got to quantify all these variables, okay? What region of the world it's in, what religion it practices, whose side it was on in the Cold War, and on and on and on, as well as the price of oil, so that he can back out all the other factors and then focus on the price of oil. In order to do that, you've got to quantify all this stuff. So for example, is a country authoritarian? Well, you've got two choices. One is you can give it a simple, you know, 0-1, no, yes, okay? Though clearly that would not be totally accurate. Clearly there are various degrees of authoritarianism. And if you don't want to go the yes or no route, then you go do this sort of spectrum route, and you've got to score it somewhere on a spectrum, and that raises the issue of arbitrariness. What I'm getting at is this is a really difficult enterprise. And it's funny to me that where he comes out is kind of the conventional wisdom, Which is, so how good the proof? Well, it's really tough at best. So he then asks, why is there a correlation? He comes up with three reasons. And the second is, let's go back and look at the record and just see if this stands up or not. This is kind of interesting from the method, from the point of view of methodology. But let me just go through the three reasons why there would be such a correlation. So the first is, the oil state can buy favor. As you remember from your American colonial history, one of the complaints of the colonists that was that the English Parliament was taxing the colonists, but there were no colonials sitting in the Parliament. And this was summed up by that there's taxation without representation, and we don't like that. There should be no taxation without representation. In the case of the oil state, you don't need taxation. The state is getting so much money from the oil revenue that it can basically leave the citizens alone. So you can say, you know, there's no taxation, so we don't have to have representation. We don't have to listen to the people. And in fact, we can provide for them, provide schools and hospitals and whatnot, provide all kinds of social services, and so gain in public favor without having to actually do anything except pump oil and sell it. Francis, pay attention. Okay. So that's one reason. In fact, the case of Venezuela is quite on point here. In 2005, there was, oh, I see all, don't worry about that. In 2005, the government of Hugo Chavez was subject to a recall, and it was quite close in the run-up to the election. The price of oil was happily running up at the same time as the election was running up, and Chavez basically doubled his budget for social services and defeated the recall. So this is one example of how an oil state can use the revenue to buy popular favor without having to actually deliver anything in the way of responsive government. So that's one thing. The second, the oil state can buy guns, can have a really well-equipped police force or secret service or army or whatnot, and so sort of defy public opinion. You know, there's nothing you can do about the government. The government has a monopoly of force, and you're completely overawed. And the third thing is that the oil state doesn't have to develop, doesn't have to modernize. The idea is that the process of modernization itself creates social forces that make for more democracy. And we see examples of this in Korea or Taiwan. As you industrialize, you need a more educated workforce, and wealth spreads among more and more of the population. Both of these things create social pressures to basically let the people in on the government. But an oil state, and not only that, but countries have to modernize for the reasons we've discussed several times before. If you don't modernize, the demographic transition gets you in the exploding population. You know, it leads to mass starvation. And you can't compete militarily, and people who have modernized will eat your lunch, like England versus China in the Opium War. And people basically want the fruits of modernization, and so you have to modernize if only to satisfy their material desires. So that's why states have to modernize, and in the process of modernizing, create forces making for democracy. But, okay, those rules don't apply to the oil state. The oil state can defend itself militarily by using the oil money to buy guns. It doesn't have to modernize to buy guns. The oil state can satisfy its people materially, again, through the oil revenues. Okay? So the oil state can survive in the modern age without being modern itself. So these are the reasons that the article adduces for why it is, according to the article, that oil prevents or inhibits the spread of democracy. So now let me look at the record. Okay, Is it true that you have oil states on the one hand and democratic states on the other? Okay. Well, maybe. For one thing, there are lots of democracies that have oil. Like Canada, Norway, USA, England, Netherlands. So that kind of blows a big hole in the thing. Now you have to amend the law to say, well, if you already had democratic institutions before the big world oil market developed, you can probably keep the institution. So what we really mean is, as you're a developing country, not an already developed country, with oil, then the oil will inhibit the spread of democracy. So is that true? Are there developing democracies with oil? Well, there's certainly a lot that aren't. Around the Persian Gulf, you have Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Iraq under Saddam Hussein and the Gulf states, the Emirates. None of them are democracies. In Latin America, you've got Venezuela, not a democracy, and Bolivia, not becoming less democratic. And in Africa, you've got Nigeria and the Sudan, not democratic, and on and on. So it's easy to get corroborating instances. But corroboration doesn't give you a law. A law is something that survives counterexamples, that doesn't have counterexamples. If there are counterexamples, then there's something wrong with the law. So are there counterexamples? Well, let's try Mexico. Mexico was an oil exporter in the 1970s. As oil prices spiked up in the 1970s, first because of the oil boycott in 73, and then the Iranian Revolution in 79, Mexico took advantage of that, used its oil revenues to borrow money extensively. As it did so, it found itself deeply in debt, but the banks didn't care. The oil money will enable Mexico to pay the loans. Then in 1982, the oil price collapsed. Mexico was unable to repay the loans. It went into default. It couldn't get any credit for the rest of the 1980s. What was the response of Mexico to this situation? Okay, it decided not to be a petrostate anymore, but to abandon ISI, development on its own. It sponsored NAFTA, the purpose of which was very little to do with the United States, as we'll see next week, mostly to do with opening Mexico, and particularly the Mexican states along the U.S. border, to manufacturing from the U.S. As it did these things, it began to democratize. Mexico, for decades, had been virtually a one-party state, the way Singapore is virtually a one-party state. In 2000, it actually had a competitive election, and the ruling party actually lost. In 2006, they have one six-year term for their presidents. So there was another election in 2006, very closely contested. Okay? So this is as strong a counterexample as you can get to the idea that if you're an oil exporter, have a big oil trade, you won't democratize, because it's just a screaming counterexample. In Southeast Asia, we have four oil exporting states. We've got Myanmar, Burma, which is as bad as you can get. And we've got Brunei, which is one of these basically surviving monarchies. But you also have Indonesia and Malaysia. I would say both of those do count as democracies. And this is in a region which includes Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos, in which democracy doesn't flourish, frankly, that well. So if anything, oil states in Southeast Asia are doing a little better than the average. Okay, so much for that. Let's try a few more. Yeah. Yeah, and the reason is, and you've brilliantly anticipated the next 15 minutes of the lecture, which is that It sounds like oil means free money from heaven forever, as if oil price goes da-da-da-da-da. But as we know, it goes more like this. Yes? It's wildly variable. And so if you know what you're doing, you don't place all your reliance on oil if you have a choice. And you start getting into other things. For instance? I'm going to get to that. I mean, we're everybody's really on all fours today. So on with the counterexamples. Actually, a better example is like Kuwait, because nothing grows in Kuwait, yes? So I would say, so Kuwait is like a pure oil state, or Saudi is like a pure oil state. And that's probably a better example of whether you can survive long term as an authoritarian state. But if you're mixed at all, if you've got any alternative to being an oil state, Mexico tells us it well behooves you to develop those other things. Anyway, back to this. So does oil enable you to build a fearsome military and police force and crush the opposition? Well, that's what the Shah tried to do. And he was lucky to get out with his life. So basically, no. Let's try Nigeria. Does having a lot of oil revenues enable you to win popular favor so the government is stable? Well, the government of Nigeria is not stable because it doesn't actually spend any money on popular favor. It basically spends money on all the friends and relations of whoever manages to get to be president. Okay? So Iran says you don't necessarily get to stay in power by having a big police force. Nigeria says you don't necessarily stay in power by having money to spend. It depends on who and what you spend it on. So there are counterexamples all over the place. I don't say that there's absolutely nothing to it. One more I wanted to do. The Congo. This is not oil, but it's other kinds of minerals, so it works kind of the same way. The Congo has uranium and cobalt and gold and diamonds and coltan, which is a mineral that's apparently used for cell phones, so you can see just how key that is to everything. So does oil buy security do these minerals buy security to the Congo? And the answer is just the opposite. They provide something for all the neighboring states to want to loot. So the Congo is perpetually being invaded by all its neighbors trying to grab the uranium field or the diamond mine or the coltan deposit, whatever it may happen to be. So I'm not saying oil or minerals are totally irrelevant. I'm saying they don't guarantee anything. So maybe there is kind of a statistical correlation between having oil and not having a democracy, but there are so many counterexamples in each direction that if there is a law, it's so weak that it's practically irrelevant. So, you know, I mean, it's fun as a springboard for discussion, but that's about as far as it goes, I think. Now we get back to oil prices and Rachel's comment. So this is kind of the cocktail party or the cocktail napkin that Friedman had in his book. Let's look at the real or the actual way in which oil prices go or have gone. So here we are back in like 1970. Then we had the 73 oil boycott. Then the Iranian Revolution. Then oil prices crashed. Okay. Then the early 2000s, they started to go up again. Crashed again last year. So the curve, so here's time and here's price. Looks something like this. Where are we? So this would be like 1975. And this would be like 1982. As you can see, I didn't do it exactly right to scale. And this would be about 2000. So what I'm saying is if you're an oil state that's relying on its oil resources, you know, to fund your army, to provide social services, to keep the people happy, and on, you're relying on one of the most unstable things you can think of to rely on. So if you have any brains at all, like, say, you're the government of Mexico, you'll try to diversify and get into other things besides oil. If there are no other things besides oil, you'll try to save money during the good years and invest it in other countries so that you can bring in money that way during the out years. You sure as heck, unlike Chavez in Venezuela, You sure as heck can't rely on that. And this is what I want to spend the next 15 or 20 minutes on, which is basically how come oil prices are so variable. And the reason I want to bring this up, and it's partly to actually do some geography, which I like to do from time to time, is what the conventional wisdom on oil is what? Basically, we're using up the oil that's found in the Earth's crust, and as we use it up, it gets rarer and rarer, and as it gets rarer and rarer, the price goes up and up, right? So this is the conventional wisdom of the oil market, and this is the reality of the oil market. Yes? So how come? So when I started looking at this stuff, oh, by the way, I'm giving a course in the first summer semester on population and resources, so this is kind of a coming attraction. Okay, so the conventional wisdom is that the oil price is going up as the oil supply is depleted more and more. One reason I began to be skeptical of the conventional wisdom is that we've had these, we're running out of oil any minute now, going on for the last century. In 1919, I think it was, the oil industry or some oil analyst calculated the amount of reserves known to exist, divided it by the rate of use per year, which I shorthanded on the outline as R over U. Okay, so if there's a finite amount of oil reserves, let's say 100 gallons, and you're using 10 gallons a year, that tells you that you're going to run out in 10 years. So this calculation was made in 1919, and it was announced that we were going to run out of oil in 1933. So what's interesting is not just that that was, you know, wrong, but what was wrong with it? Okay? There's nothing wrong with the basic idea. You take the amount of reserves, divide it by the rate of use, that tells you how many years are left. Okay? What's wrong is basically the conventional wisdom about what R means, what reserves are. So are these numbers R and U, are they constants or are they variables? U is clearly a variable, right? The amount we use from one year to another can go up or down, generally up. In the last year, down, but generally up. Okay, is R a constant or a variable? Huh? You got to talk louder for me to hear you. Who said constant? Okay, that's wrong. So, you see, the convention, and it's interesting because the idea is that the amount, and I kind of misled you on purpose, the amount of oil on Earth, okay, is what people think is meant by oil reserves. And the amount of oil in the Earth's crust, whatever it is, probably is constant. There probably isn't more stuff being created. Yeah? So the amount of oil on Earth is a constant, but that's not what oil reserves are. What oil reserves mean is the known amount recoverable economically using current techniques. So, for example, let's assume hypothetically that there's a trillion barrels of oil under the Antarctic ice cap. Okay? They don't qualify as oil reserves because nobody knows they're there. Okay, reserves are known. If we somehow found out by some kind of imaging that they were there, they still wouldn't be part of the reserves because it would cost probably $1,000 a barrel to get at them through all that ice. Okay? What would make them the reserves are, A, if we discovered them, and B, we discovered how to get them and at a price that made sense economically. So therefore, we can count just how many variables are packed into R. Okay? R can vary because Yeah, find more. Develop new techniques so that stuff that used to be hard to get is not as hard. Find more, by the way, can include substitutes like tar or shale. Or even economically. I mean, if the price doubles, if the price goes up, then there's some stuff on the margin that it didn't make sense to develop before. Now that the price is up, it does make sense to develop it. So from year to year, the amount of oil of known oil reserves as defined, okay, can go up and down. It's a variable. And the amount we use can go up and down. It's a variable. So the oil price can go up and down in a wildly variable way. It's not a straight line function. It's not that if demand doubles, the price doubles. If demand is 82 million barrels a day, which I think it is, and the supply is 83, the price can be down around $40 a barrel. If demand then goes from 82 to 84, okay, the people bidding for that missing, so to speak, million barrels of oil, even though it's only 1/84th of the total, will send the price skying up, okay, into the hundreds, as happened last year. So basically, we take into account both R and U. If demand or use is increasing faster than we're finding new stuff or recovering stuff, then the price will go up. And if use is stagnant or falling or growing very slowly and we're finding and bringing online lots of new stuff, then the price will fall. And that's what's been happening. So let me briefly segue into the last article for today, which is China's global hunt for energy. So, what drove the price up in the early years of this decade? Basically, it was increased demand largely from Asia. Supply was growing, but outpacing the growth of supply. It's generally believed that if an economy is growing at rate X, then its demand for energy will grow at something like 1.1X. So if China's economy is doubling in size in 7 years, its demand for energy will be more than doubling in size in those 7 years, and that is what happened. The Chinese economy actually quadrupled in size between 1996 and 2007, and as it did so, its demand for oil, for energy generally, rather, I should say, because coal was kind of, but its demand for energy will quadruple as the size of the economy quadrupled 1996 to 2007. By the way, there's a talk at in Bechtel Engineering at 6 o'clock by Orville Schell, the former dean of the School of Journalism, on why China must be brought into the Kyoto Accords in order for them to have any chance of success. And this is basically why. China is already the world's greatest energy user and CO2 outputter, and a carbon control regime that doesn't include China is not including the lion's share of the issue, okay? So that's what Orville's going to say, I'm sure, and only he'll say it better than I say it. Okay, so increased Asian demand, outpacing supply in this period, drove up the price of oil. We'll go back to it again when we discuss Kyoto in a couple of weeks. What I want to discuss it now is in relationship to the Sudan in the next, like, 3 minutes, which, as you probably know, has an atrocious record on human rights. And there's a combination of a civil war and ethnic cleansing going on in southwest Sudan. in which hundreds of thousands of people have been killed so far. And there have been attempts to organize an international boycott as a way of bringing the government of the Sudan to heel, partly on a country-by-country basis and partly through the United Nations. Okay, the sort of poster child for organizing boycotts in response to human rights violations is South Africa as of 17 years ago under the apartheid regime, in which there was a virtually unanimous international boycott of South Africa, and the regime recognized that it simply could not survive with every other country in the world shunning it. Okay, can that work here? And the answer is, if there's the key word in what I just said was unanimous. If there's one big country that will not participate in the boycott, then the boycott is not going to work. So that's what the article, China's Global Hunt for Energy, is all about. Will China participate in a boycott of the Sudan? No, because the Sudan has something for sale, namely its oil, that China will do, that China desperately needs. And so China could really care less what kind of government there is in the Sudan, as long as the Sudan is willing, which it is, of course, to enter into oil contracts with China. So what I'm saying is, in addition to the internal reasons adduced in the first article about how oil, you know, enables you to be authoritarian, there's yet another reason which may be as significant as the first three, which is oil renders you, or oil gives you impunity. Or invulnerability to international condemnation. You can be just as bad as you want to be. As long as you've got oil for sale, you will find a ready buyer. And it will not be possible to sanction you out of existence, as did happen in the case of South Africa. Not possible. There's another case, this is the Sudan, there's another case that's exactly on all fours with this, Myanmar or Burma. Myanmar enjoys the same human rights reputation in Southeast Asia that the Sudan enjoys in Africa, okay? But exactly the same dynamic takes place. The U.S. and Britain will not do business with Burma at all, okay? But they have a big friend right next door here. Again, China, it's like that old science fiction movie, Mars Needs Women. Well, China needs oil. It's the same kind of deal. And as long as that's true, and I think, you know, for the foreseeable future, oil gives you impunity. You are not subject to external pressure as long as you do have oil. Okay, China's position on this is, look, we just mind our own business. They have the kind of government they have. We have the kind of government we have. The U.S. has the kind of government it has. And everybody should basically mind their own business and get along on that basis. And, of course, that position suits China very well because it absolves it from any need to take a position on what kind of characters it's doing business with and what kind of regimes it's enabling to remain in existence. But, again, China doesn't care about that. China cares about the fact that its demand for oil is going to triple in the next 10 years. Okay, so that's about where I wanted to get to today, and I actually managed to finish on time, so that's great. All right, I'll see you next time. We'll discuss Japan and maybe the United States.